With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, Francis.
That's a private part.
It's very bright behind you.
Yeah, sorry. Listen, I'm self-isolating. I'm in Henley.
Where are you in Henley?
I don't want to do what I did to you on the podcast where I told you exactly where you live in the middle of Pusey. Can I tell you though, my apartment, right, it's got 1, 2, 3, it's got 8 different blinds, right? 8 different blinds. And last night I arrived here for self-isolating for this TV show. And I went to close the blinds and I couldn't shut them. I was like, what the hell? So I found this little controller, pressed it, and they're remote control blinds. So they go down by the controller. I was like, oh, this is cool. I had to find 8 different controllers to close each blind. It was like a Easter egg.
It wasn't a universal one.
Yeah, there's not a universal one. There's 8 different ones. 8 different controllers in the house that you have to find, like an Easter egg hunt, and you have to find them all.
But why don't you just record facing the window so there's light on you?
I am, but I did that in the podcast that we just did. I'm just recharging my laptop now, so that's why I'm...
Oh, I think that was a cracking episode.
Gonna say it, said it before, but I'm actually gonna say it again. Possibly one of my favourite ever.
Yeah, well, I would have to agree. It's definitely up there.
We had, ladies and gentlemen, Rafael Rowe. Some people call him Raphael, some people call him Raph, but actually his name is Rafael Rowe. Rafael was sentenced to prison for murder for 12 years. And after 12 years, he was found not guilty. He was wrongfully accused for murder and he was released back into the world. And his story of how he was wrongfully accused, how he lived in prison, how he fought the justice system every single day for 12 years through anger and through determination. He spoke
Jamie,
about
can
it.
Can you imagine? You know.
Oh, God.
You're 20, you get arrested.
Man.
This reality where you've done Made in Chelsea just is vanished. You're not on that anymore. You haven't been able to do all the Botox that you would have liked. You're 32. You're coming out. Your hair is probably its natural colour.
That's
How would you
worst.
Survive?
That's the worst thing about it. That's honestly the worst thing about it.
You're ginger. Everyone can see that you're ginger.
Honestly, I don't know if Rav is going to listen to this, but he was a complete legend. And Rafael, if you're listening to this, thank you so much for gracing us with your presence. As he says in this, he had a lot, you know, he does podcasts or gets offered podcasts all the time, and he chose our one, which is a real honor to have that. I don't think we need to give much more of an intro to this one, Francis. I think we just get on with it.
I think we should just crack on.
If you want to check out Rafael's podcast, it's called Second Chance. It's on all podcast platforms. Or get his book, Notorious, or follow him on Instagram. Also, get
Second
in touch.
Second Chance.
Get in touch with us via our podcast at private, via our social media at private podcast. Send us a DM or reviews, funny stories, anything at all. Charities, individuals, communities that you want us to donate to as well. We'd love to hear from you. Or send us an email, contact@privatepartspodcast.com. As always, we want to hear from you, you private partners, you brilliant people. Right, Francis, intro the episode.
Ladies and gentlemen, an incredible story, incredible guest. We're very excited to introduce Raphael Rowe.
Raphael Rowe.
Raphael Rowe.
On the podcast. So, Raphael, before we even begin this podcast, I said it to you before, and it sounds like I'm really sucking up to you, which I am. I'm definitely sucking up to you. There's no other way to put it. But I couldn't sleep last night. I was so excited for this podcast.
Wow.
Honestly.
Wow, that sounds like girlfriend trouble stuff, you know?
Yeah.
That sounds beyond. Sorry.
Yeah, it was nothing to do with you. It was just I had loads of nightmares. So it was just... I was just thinking about your night and it just got me very excited.
Well, look, I'm honoured to be here talking to you, Jamie, and your team. So thanks for inviting me on.
Dude, listen, you know, the funny thing is, before you came on the podcast, I said to you, how do we pronounce your name? Is it Raphael? Is it Raphael? Do I call you Raph? Like, what is it? And you said about, you know, you try and make it a bit more sexy when you go to other countries. Ah, Raphael. But it's Raphael, isn't it? And some people get it wrong, right?
My parents are the go-to here, and they call me Raphael, but... If I'm in a Spanish-speaking country or another country where their mother tongue is slightly more Frenchy or Spanishy, they call me Raphael, and I like that because it makes me sound more elegant, more exotic, and whatever. But yeah, it's plain Raphael actually. But call me Raphael or Raphael, depending on your mood. And if you're dreaming about me, no doubt it was Raphael.
No, yeah. When I was dreaming about you, I just had a pet name. It was just Raph. That's okay.
Yeah, and Raph's the easy one. So Raph, Raphael, or Raphael, whatever you fancy.
Raphael. So Francis just here. So Francis and I both have the same thing where. My surname's Lang. It's a Scottish pronunciation, but everyone my entire life has said Lang. And I've just now accepted the fact that that's what my surname is, even though it isn't. And with Francis, he has it where we did a show together and we all called him Boule. His name is Francis Bull, but anyone on the street calls him Boule and he can't stand it. Isn't that right, Francis?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess it's just not my name, is it?
No, I feel your pain, guys, because, you know, I'm not even going to attempt to say your surname, Jamie, because I'm always thinking Jamie, and I'm not going to say it. Okay, so it's Leng.
Yeah, close. It's so hard. It's such a complicated, it's Leng, but it sounds like it's meant to be, it's Leng, but everyone says Lang, and it just, honestly, it's been like that ever since I was... As I can remember, everyone has always said that. So I just consider myself Bowie. It's like, is it Bowie? Is it Bowie? I'm just the same as him.
My hair definitely looks like it's...
I know. It's a.
Have you gone a bit lighter?
Yeah, I had a little bit of a dye session with it. It didn't go to plan. It was just... Now, Raphael, I'm isolating at the moment in the beautiful Henley because I'm about to shoot a TV show down here for the next 5 weeks. So I'm a natural blonde. It's just I like to add a little bit of a tint to it occasionally, and this time it went a little bit too white. But anyway, that's beside it. Raphael, listen, as we said, we are so excited to have you on, and I can imagine that you go on to every podcast, you do your TV shows, all these different things, and the same question you get asked the whole time is about your story. And I'm going to be one of those really boring people because I know you people have heard it a million times, but our listeners will just be over the moon to hear it. Can you explain your story and what happened to you?
I've got lots of stories, but...
I know, I can't wait.
The most important one, I suppose, is being wrongfully arrested and convicted and sent to life imprisonment without the possibility of release when I was 20 years old. So at the age of 20, as a Londoner, I was arrested. I was... wrongly charged for murder in a series of robberies. I was sentenced to 18 months later when I went on trial. I was sentenced to life imprisonment without parole. And by saying without parole is not quite the same as the American system. It just simply means if you don't accept your guilt during the years that you're in prison, you're unlikely to ever be released as a lifer, as somebody who's been sentenced to life imprisonment for a mandatory life sentence. And I spent 12 long years in prison, angry, bitter and twisted at what had happened to me because I was innocent. I hadn't and wasn't guilty of the crimes that I'd been convicted of. And so I was volatile, I was anti-establishment, I was anti-system. And by that I mean I fought against the prison regime, which often ended in the consequence of me being punished by being isolated or segregated and physically beaten by prison staff, etc., etc. So it was a harrowing time. And for those 12 long years, I was held in maximum security prisons. And by that, I mean I was in single cells in prisons that were in prisons. So it was a really traumatic and tough time throughout the whole of my 20s. So, you know, your listeners can imagine, you know, 20, 21, 22, 23, 29, 30. I was still in prison, 31, 32. And eventually, through, you know, pure resilience and, you know, pen and paper, I'm talking about. I'm talking old school campaigning from the confines of my prison cell. There was a point that I did get access to a typewriter. Now, for anybody who doesn't know what a typewriter is, it's a kind of downgrade on a computer. So I spent many, many months sitting in my cell doing the tick, 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 one finger tap of a typewriter, trying to write, you know, 50 page documents, protesting my innocence, sending letters to MPs, to journalists, etc. But, you know, to summarise, wrongly convicted of murder, a series of robberies, sentenced to life imprisonment, spent 12 years in prison, maximum security prisons, four crimes I didn't commit. My convictions were overturned, and at the age of 32, 12 years later, I walked down the steps of the Court of Appeal, having had my convictions overturned.
What was the reason? What were the grounds for you, the false convictions? How did that happen? I mean, how did you end up being framed, I suppose, for...
I would say, and I've always said, it was more about fitting me and my two co-defendants into the crime as opposed to being fitted up, i.e., you know, the police often fabricate evidence or plant evidence. That's not what happened in my case. So there was no forensic evidence planted or anything like that. It was purely people standing up in a witness box saying that I did this or I did that. Despite the fact, and this is an important element, you've got to remember this happened in 1988. That's when I was arrested. Society and our culture was slightly different. Not that it's improved much if you look at what's happening around Black Lives Matter. But the fact of the matter, Francis, Jamie, is that the victims of the crimes that I was convicted of described their perpetrators as two white men and one black man. You know, they went so far as to say that one of the white men that was responsible for the crimes had blue eyes and fair hair. So Jamie would be more likely to be responsible than I was. Yet
green eyes, buddy. Green eyes. I'm out.
Close enough. Close enough. Well, it didn't matter. I've got brown eyes and I had dreadlocks at the time and I was still convicted of those crimes, as was two other black men. So racism is one of the answers to your question, Francis. You know, there was an element of racism within the police, within the witnesses that stood up and gave evidence against three black men, despite the fact that the victim said that the crimes were committed by two white men and one black man. There was also a conspiracy between the police and some witnesses to shift and move evidence. But as I reiterate, you know, there was no forensic evidence. There wouldn't be. We wasn't involved. There was no direct evidence or anything like that. It was purely a conspiracy between the police and witnesses to give fabricated evidence against me and my co-defendants.
Do you think that's because what happens is, and you know, the only way that I can relate to this is through television shows, right? And you watch movies or documentaries or television shows and stuff like that, and you see that a lot of time that the thing what happens is that they have a case, right? They've got, and in your situation, you guys were dubbed the M25-3. That's what you were dubbed because it was three people and this they had committed this crime. In these situations, what happens is that the police need to find a culprit. They need to find someone to fit the crime. So they kind of go to all ends to make sure that you fit it. you're the person. So actually, a lot of the times, it isn't about finding who's guilty. Of course it is, but it's more focused towards actually finding someone who fits the crime, because they want to just pack them and say, right, we've dealt with that one and we move on. Is that right, or am I totally wrong in saying that?
No, I think that is right, Jamie, to some extent. I think what tends to happen, like in the movies, is that the police come fixated on the people that they've arrested, and then what they tend to do, or what they did in my case, was they started to make the evidence, even when it started to point away. For example, fingerprints found on the car at the scene of the murder belonged to the white man with blue eyes and fair hair. But they only discovered that after they charged me and my co-defendant. So you'd think through police investigations that once they discovered that new piece of evidence, that they'd go back and start interrogating that suspect. Instead, they got that suspect to make claims against us. So the police start to shift the goalposts, shift the evidence, because they're already set on who they think are guilty. They believed we were guilty, but as the evidence, I was arrested and charged within 2 days. But as the evidence was gathered over a period of months, all the evidence started to point away from me and my co-defendants. But the police didn't then come and de-arrest us and let us go. What they did is they started to change witnesses' statements. And I mean independent witness statements. And they'd already paid a huge amount of money as a reward to witnesses that they never told us about. We still don't even have those documents today. So there is an element that the police do, you know, go and fixate on particular individuals. And because I was no angel, you know, I had been in trouble with the police, lots of people around me were petty criminals. And then the sensational headlines, as you just alluded to, you know, the M25 free, the Kill for Kicks gang, you know, the police are hunting these men, you know, the sensational...
It sells papers. It sells, doesn't it?
It sells papers, and wrongly convicted individuals like myself are the consequence of those headlines, because the headline was the police are hunting this gang. Within 2 days, the police have charged those responsible. You can all rest easily in your beds now because this gang has been arrested, charged and locked up. And then everybody does. They kind of turn a cheek and look at what the next headlines are whilst I'm sitting in a prison cell. Not just a prison. I was in a prison within a prison at 20 years old. And by that, I mean, you know, confined in a cell inside a prison that was built inside another prison with some of Britain's most dangerous criminals.
But that's the thing. It's so fascinating, isn't it, that the prosecution, I guess it's, well, Crown prosecution in this case. I mean, they're... motivation, you know, it seems sometimes can be conflicted, because they have the motivation to put the nation or the country at ease, you know, and you know, arrest people who you know, or convince people that they've arrested the people that have committed some crime, some violent crime or whatever. But then also, I think it's just about stats. They want to get those crimes solved, right? If they don't have a solved crime, then there's just this hanging case that hasn't been. So it is a bit of a conflict of interest there, right?
I think that's a structure. I mean, you could argue that's a structural thing, Francis. But you know, you'd think that these people that become Crown prosecutors, they're individuals. They don't become a Crown prosecutor as a team, as a collective. Mm. So what happens between them training to become a prosecutor who wants to ensure that an offender or somebody who's committed a horrible crime or a trivial crime gets punished rightly, justly? You know, where does the line start to blur, where they then actively participate in the fabrication or the misguiding and misleading of evidence that leads to wrongfully convicted people? I should stress that at the time of my arrest in 1988, the Crown Prosecution Service was in its infancy. It had only been set up a couple of years before. So you're right in saying that they were desperately keen to show that they were a service that were going to do good, because they replaced the police who were at that time responsible for arrest, prosecution and, you know, conducting trials. So the Crown Prosecution Service in this country was introduced in 1986, around 2 years before I was arrested, because of police corruption. And then they get embroidered in the same police behaviour. Wow. That's my view.
So it was a young organisation at that time, and I guess it was still sort of finding its feet and, you know. Yeah,
big case like crazy. The M25-3, successful conviction. You know, it's a pat on the back all round.
That's what it is, the gold stars. They get gold stars.
It's horrible to think that, though, isn't it? It's horrible to think that people like me suffer as a consequence of people trying to get further in their careers.
Yeah, but Rafael, what's more upsetting, I suppose, I'm in isolation at the moment, and I suppose it sort of relates. A lot of people have been in isolation over the past year, right? And lots of us. That doesn't even compare to what you experienced when you're in, I don't even know what size the cell was. You can probably tell us.
9 by 6.
9 by 6. Okay, you're stuck in the cell. You're 20 years old. You have all the energy in the world. You have your life ahead of you. Your liberty is stripped away from you with something that you haven't done. You're a black man, which means that, you know, at the time there was racism. It was rife. There was things going on. So, you know, it was even harder for you to even get heard. And you have to sit there in that cell and just with your own thoughts. I just don't know how you push past that. And you talked about resilience, right? And I think there's resilience and there's resilience. I think resilience is, you know, you're getting through like a tough mudder, right? That is getting through a marathon. That's resilience, right? What you experienced and went through, that is more than resilience. That is, I mean, I there isn't a word for it, I don't think.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Did you reach a point, Rafael, of sort of acceptance of the circumstances, or did you? Because I guess that's one way of dealing with it, right?
No,
because you kept fighting, right? Didn't you?
I never did. Listen, when I was sat in that cell, and you're right, Jamie, at 20 years old, and I didn't know all the evidence. You know, when I was in that cell within a cell, I mean, I was in Brixton Prison, and inside, as I say, in Brixton Prison, they had a prison built within a prison, and this was for some of the most dangerous prisoners, you know, IRA convicted, etc. You know, I was in there with Freddie Foreman, a notorious gangster, one of the Richardsons, who is, again, a notorious Southeast London gangster. So these are the kinds of guys that I was confined with at 20 years old. They were in their 40s, you know, so they were experienced guys who'd look at this little kid with dreadlocks kind of ruffling on. And you've got to remember, you know, prison in those days when I was in there, I was pissing in a piss pot and pooing in a potty, you know, a transparent chamber pot that I kept under my bed, and every day for 18 months I would empty that in a recess with another 20 guys that were being held in this confined space. But you asked how I coped in that environment. I suppose it was the anger. There was this deep rooted anger inside me every day that got me out of bed and oozed into my legs that made me walk to empty that piss pot. That, you know, you talk about being young and all that energy. You know, my face as a 20-year-old was happy when I was confined in that space. It almost contorted into a pain that has never left my expression. You know, when I naturally sit there watching television, you think I'm angry because I have that embedded anger in me that has never, ever left me. But I suppose the key is that I was able to turn that anger into sitting on that cell floor with paperwork all around me, trying to find the bits of information and evidence that I could go out and sit down and talk to my lawyers about. He said this, she said that, that's wrong, look at this, this is inconsistent. That's what drove me, trying to show every day that they were lying. And that's what I did.
God, do you know what, it's not a true word spoken. It is this thing, you know, anger, right, is seen as like a negative thing, right? It's, if you're angry, it's a negative thing. But actually, that's the thing that kept you alive at that point. And you does, you know, you need, I think hope is a killer. I think hope kills, you know, whether you break up in a relationship, I think hope's a killer. But anger or I mean, anger actually is the one that really, if you're angry at something, and you know, it's like Nelson Mandela, right, always says, there's that famous quote which he says, seeking revenge is like drinking poison and wanting the other person to die. It only kills yourself, right? But actually, in your situation, because you knew that you were the right and you were so angry about it, that forced you to get up. I just can't even imagine getting up every single day and thinking, shit, okay, this is the day that I have to do it again. 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 I take cold showers in the morning, right? That takes me a long time to get underneath that shower and do it. I can hardly do it, let alone wake up every single day in prison and getting through it. Rafael, I mean, and I don't, you know, because there's so many other stories for you to go through, but I also want, you know, I saw you describe it, that you were in your bed and your door was broken down and you were woken up and told that you had committed murder. Is that right? Is that pretty much what happened in a sense?
I think it's a little bit more dramatic than that. Yeah,
yeah, sorry to really dumb it down. Some guys has knocked on your door.
I wish it was as simple as that. No, I was woken on the morning of the 19th of December 1988 by my flat door being broken down by armed police, and I was confronted by these police officers pointing guns at me. And at one point, you know, they made to shoot for me. I mean, you only have to look at what's happening in Minnesota in America at the moment. You know, a police officer points a gun, they panic and they shoot. Luckily, I had my hands in the air and I only had my boxer shorts on. So, they could see that I wasn't concealing a weapon. I'd never held a weapon or anything like that. So I'm standing there, bollock naked, apart from my shorts, with my hands in the air. But I did have a cigarette in my mouth, funnily enough, because when I woke up, I thought it was my flatmate and his brother arguing, and that's what the commotion was. So as I kind of rubbed the sleep from my eyes and lit a cigarette, as you do, instead of a spliff at 20, and I went downstairs to investigate, that's when I was confronted by these police. So imagine for a moment, I'm standing there, my hands are in the air, in the doorway of my flat, there are police officers on their knees and standing with kind of shotguns or weapons pointed at me. They also wore balaclavas because they were these elite arrest police officers. So I didn't at the time know, until they were saying, police, put your hands in the air. So the cigarette's in my mouth, it's burning down, it gets to the point where it's almost burning my lip, for those who don't know. So I'm kind of trying to move it out of my lips, which are dry and the cigarette's stuck. I reached to take the cigarette from my mouth, and I thought at that point, when one of the police officers dropped to the floor and told me that they would shoot if I didn't put my hands in the air, and you could see I didn't have anything on me. So it was all part of the intimidation process. It was all part of the strategy, I think, by the police. I'm thinking back now of showing the public that they were arresting these very dangerous guys. Mm. And I was handcuffed, brought out of my flat backwards, dragged down the stairs. And that was the last I saw freedom for 12 years.
Oh, mate. Do you know what? Wow. I just want to say sorry. I mean, that is just all. I can't imagine a human just going through that. It's uncomparable. I can't even think of it. But then also, I read, and I don't know if you feel free also to really not speak about anything that you don't want to, but I heard that you were in being convicted, and your girlfriend stood up and went on trial against you, and then later apologized for it. I mean, can you? What was that? What happened there?
It's a little bit more complicated than that, because I had quite a few girlfriends at 20 years old. I'm proud, or not so proud to say.
But you're lighting up a cigarette. You're just like, oh.
Well, look, I mean, what happened was one of the girlfriends that I was sort of sleeping with. She was also my alibi, because on the night that the murder and these robberies were committed, I was with her and a bunch of other girls and boys way after the crimes had actually been committed. So she was a key alibi. But what happened was, when I was arrested and the police then rounded up all the people that they could and I would say intimidated them, she gave false evidence to the police, saying that after the point about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning, I left her and went out and came back and had diamonds from one of the robberies. The police were in possession of these diamonds. The problem was the murder was committed at 12 o'clock. So that suggests that I couldn't have been there. The first robbery was committed at about between 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, 15 miles away from my location. So what happened was, when I was sat in that cell in Brixton Prison, in that prison within a prison, I received a letter from the same girl who'd given this statement to the police. So she hadn't given evidence to the court at this point. It was just a statement to the police, which I believe that they manipulated and made her write, apologising and saying that she was sorry for giving false evidence and that she didn't realise what she was doing at the time. And you'd think that that would have been the key to my freedom, but it wasn't, because the prosecution didn't accept that. And so it
why didn't they accept that? I didn't get it.
Because it would mean something very simple, that they'd got it wrong, that they'd locked up not only three black men for crimes committed by two white men and one black man, but also a man that had a cast iron alibi. And so they were hell-bent on presenting a case that questioned any part of our defence. I mean, even the judge said, for example, that the fact that I had an alibi made the prosecution case impossible to prove. But if you believe that alibi, why wouldn't people believe independent witnesses? And I'll give you an example. We are here right now, Jamie, Francis and Raphael, and your audience listening to this podcast. A crime is being committed 10 miles away. 3 days later, Jamie gets arrested. God forbid, he's put in the prison within a prison. Me and Francis come to court and say, well, hold on a minute, we were doing a podcast at the time this crime was committed. So Jamie couldn't have committed the crime. Jamie still gets convicted and sent to prison for life. That's what I was up against.
Wow.
Oh my God.
So not only have I got to live with the torment of being wrongfully imprisoned, but the witnesses who knew that I wasn't at the crime when the crimes were committed had to live with the fact that they knew I didn't commit. But
yeah.
What could they do? They got to get on with their lives. They're 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds, 18-year-olds. They have to get on with their lives.
Doesn't the guilt eat you? I'm sure guilt, you'd be like, this is wrong. You would.
But what can they do? They did all they could do, Jamie, by standing up in the court and saying, I was with Raphael at 12 o'clock. The girlfriend said I was in bed making love for an hour. Now, I'm a stallion, so, you know, I joke about it.
You said that's a lie. It was two.
I should have stopped. But, you know, the point is that was all presented to a jury, and the jury didn't believe it. The judges didn't believe it. Why? Because the prosecution and the police are far more powerful than the defence. Simple.
Do you think the jury had been influenced by the press at the time? I mean, because I
think they were. I also think that the prosecutor was very skilled in saying to the jury, look at these three black men in the dock. Two of them have dreadlocks. One of them is dark skin. And we know that black boys in South London, we know that black boys in England are predominantly involved in criminality. We were criminalised before we stood in the dock. So it was an easy picture to paint.
Mm. And the other defendants, you know, were they your friends, or were they just other random people that they picked off the street?
No, one of them was my best friend. We were a duo. The other guy I didn't know at all.
He was a complete stranger.
He was a complete stranger to me, but he did know my other co-defendant and some other people, but I didn't know him at all.
Oh, that moment, Raphael, and sorry to really bring it back to this Mary, but it's just, I mean, you know, it's just unforgivable, I think. That moment when you're in court and your sentence is told, you said that you were found guilty. What is that feeling like, that you suddenly just realise it? So are you saying, well, they've made a mistake, so I'm going to go, okay, it's fine, we're going to fight this? Or is it, I don't know what to say here, but is it an unthinkable feeling?
it breaks you as a person, doesn't it? It's like something inside snaps and disconnects from one part of your body to another part of your body. I mean, it was all wrong that I, you know, was held in this cell for 18 months. But as the documents came in and I saw the evidence that was being mounted against me, it was quite clear that the trial, the jury couldn't convict because of the overwhelming evidence. When you saw it as a whole, individual parts of the evidence, it would convince anybody. But when you saw it collectively... So when I was convicted, when the jury came back and said guilty, I changed at that very moment. I went from I was now 21, and I went from a 21-year-old almost to an old man overnight in terms of my body, my structure and everything. You kind of collapse in on yourself thinking this is the end of my life. But I shouted, I screamed, as did everybody else who were supporting me in that court at the time. And I suppose from that moment on, where I fought with the guards that were holding me in the dock, I didn't stop fighting for 12 years. And sometimes a lot of that was physical. You know, I went through that physical phase of always challenging the system. I would never, ever, and never did accept what was happening to me. Never, not for one moment.
I remember watching this documentary on Netflix. I'm going to talk about your podcast, your Netflix shows, all this kind of stuff. But I watched this documentary on Netflix called, it's a famous story called The Staircase, about the guy who, you know, was wrongfully accused, and, you know, he was told that he murdered his wife pushing down the stairs, and you know, he went to prison, and then it documents the whole thing, and you see him in prison, and he's been in there for 10 years or something like that.
Are you
and
talking about Making a Murderer?
No, it's called The Staircase.
I've seen it.
The Staircase. And you see his physique and his face, and when he's in prison behind, you know, when they go to talk to him and he's behind the glass, his whole body's changed. He looks like he's aged 20 years, 30 years. And I suppose that's what happens to an individual, as you said, when their liberty is taken away from you. Rafael, normally at this point what we do is we are asked a question of the week, but I honestly am I have so many more questions for you, and I know we only have sort of, I don't want to take up all of your day. So I'm going to end part one there, but you're going to stick around for part two.
Of course, no, I'm looking forward to it, can't wait.
Okay, sweet. Listen, everyone, we'll see you in part two.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.